From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now. Mexico's foreign secretary is in Washington today, trying to avoid a standoff with the United States. The Mexican president sent his representative after President Trump threatened yesterday to impose a 5% tariff on all goods from Mexico until, quote, illegal migrants coming through Mexico and into our country stop. Those tariffs could rise to 25%, and now there are concerns about what they would mean for the new trade agreement that's supposed to replace NAFTA. The USMCA is now before Congress for ratification. Michael Regan is senior editor at Bloomberg News. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Peter.
So Mexico's foreign secretary is already on the ground in Washington today. Is that a sign of how serious this is?
Oh, yes, absolutely. I mean, this caught presumably everyone in Mexico a little bit off guard. It's caught the financial markets off guard. And as you mentioned, this trade deal is going before not only the U.S. Congress, but it's time for the Mexican Congress to ratify it. Based on the timeline of that, it's a very urgent negotiation that needs to be done in order to meet sort of the timeline goals that were set out for the ratification of the new trade deal.
I mentioned this tariff would include all goods from Mexico. Needless to say, that is a country that is very important to the U.S. economy. We import avocados, grapes, produce, not to mention car parts, Mike. One Deutsche Bank analyst predicts that these tariffs could add $1,300 to the price of a car.
Yeah, right. The value of cars, trucks, buses, and other vehicles imported from Mexico is something like $70 billion. And what really complicates matters is how closely connected the supply chain is in the U.S. and Mexico. You know, the metals might be produced in one country. They're shipped to the other country where parts are made, and then those parts are shipped back for more work. And oftentimes, a part can cross the border several times before the finished product is produced. So it's very complicated from a supply chain point of view, and it's not clear exactly if that thing would be hit with a tariff every time it crosses the border. So it's a lot of confusion for people trying to figure out what exactly the impact of this will be.
The Mexican president, Andres Manuel Lopez Obrador, wrote a letter to President Trump yesterday. He said that social issues are not solved by tariffs and that Mexico wants a truce, but the homeland has to be first. What does it look like Mexico is willing to do here? Are they considering retaliating with tariffs of their own? Do they want to get into a trade war?
Well, so far, the Mexican president, as you say, he's been remarkably mild-mannered and sort of calm about this. And the question is how long that will last. Everyone's wondering if he will come under a lot of pressure to sort of fight back more aggressively and retaliate. And, you know, obviously the question of retaliation is an open one. Obviously tariffs on U.S. imports into Mexico would be the most likely one to imagine first.
Look, throughout all these conversations about tariffs, including with China, a lot of supporters of the president have said, great idea, China takes advantage of us. Great idea, Mexico takes advantage of us. What do you think? Could these tariffs actually have a chance of working and actually force Mexico to crack down on immigration?
It certainly will light a fire for them to come up with some way to show that they are trying to fight this problem. The thing is, though, the goals are sort of fuzzy at the moment. The White House says it has the sole discretion over whether Mexico is complying with these demands. So we're not quite sure what that means. Stopping 100% the flow of illegal immigrants coming over the border is a pretty lofty goal. And it's not clear Mexico really has the resources to do that. So how and if they comply with President Trump's demands, it's very fuzzy what that would look like and what would satisfy him at the moment. So that is another thing that's adding a lot of uncertainty to this story.
If this continues to escalate and you have a trade war with China and now a potential trade war with Mexico, what does it mean, big picture, for the U.S. economy?
Well, obviously it's not good. It should weigh on growth, GDP growth. Worst case scenario, it might start weighing on employment. You know, a lot of companies are just going to not know what to do as far as their supply chains, and they might end up laying people off and at the same time raising prices. So sort of a stagflation environment would be the worst case scenario.
The other possibility is this is just a bluff from the president. Michael Regan, senior editor at Bloomberg News. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Well, Peter, I have to say that one of the most difficult words recently for me to spell, weirdly, is tariff, because I can never remember whether there's one R, two R's, two F's, whatever.
Same
it
problem.
Is one R, two F's.
Same
okay,
problem.
Okay. So this brings me to an historic moment at the Scripps National Spelling Bee last night. Listen to this.
Odilic. O-D-Y-L-I-C. Odilic.
You are correct. It's complete.
The Elite Eight. After 20 rounds in the competition, the judges named all of the spellers who remained co-champions, an unprecedented victory in the Bee's 92-year history, and social media is buzzing about it. So let's bring in Femi Okeh, host of the stream on Al Jazeera English, for our weekly roundup. And Femi, I'm here in Washington with you today,
yeah.
So it's nice to see you in
nice
person.
Nice to see you. Those judges wanted to go home. Those kids would still be spelling now.
Exactly. This must have been just
so much joy.
A big on social media.
Oh, it's fascinating because it was a stream. You can watch it as a sport on ESPN. We know this has been going on for decades and decades. The phrase, the new hashtag that is out now is hashtag OctoChamps. And that was thought up by one of the young winners himself. Abhijay Kodali came up with the own nickname for the own winners, all eight of them all together. And there are so many winners that even Scripps hadn't anticipated it. They had four cups ready. Four trophies ready, because you can see all of this on social
right.
media, but not eight. They thought, well, maybe we might have four winners, but definitely not eight. And then social is thinking, well, how do you capitalize on this? If you're really good at spelling, Vasu suggests, I am shocked that every Indian male doesn't just put Spelling Bee Champ on his Tinder profile. Result.
Now that there are eight of them. But we remember, of course, there are what? How many? More than a billion Indians in the world. So a lot of them not spelling champions.
And those youngsters are too young to be thinking about dating.
Exactly. Okay, let's talk about another big competition last night. The Golden State Warriors faced off against the Toronto Raptors in Game 1 of the NBA Finals. Raptors won 118-109, even though the Warriors have been the favorites here. But the rapper Drake is once again taking over the headlines for his courtside antics. At one point, during a timeout, he had a quick chat with Steph Curry from the Warriors, and later what appeared to be a tense exchange with the Warriors forward Draymond Green. What are they saying on social media?
Well, Adam Silver, who is
the
from
NBA
the NBA, yeah, and he said to Drake, you know, we love you being there, but can you just tone it down a little bit? He walks around as if he owns the court. He walks around as if he's a player. It's really fun if you're on social media because his moods, you can see them on his face. He turns into 1,000 memes. Adam Silver says, we spoke with Drake. He'll behave himself. Drake literally at the same time walks in wearing Steph's dad's jersey. That's Stephen Curry's jersey. So he is almost a fixture at the Raptors games, and it's kind of fun to see him on the sidelines, but he has been asked to tone it down. I don't think he got the note.
Well, Steph's dad, by the way, played for the Raptors back in the late 90s, so he's wearing a Raptors jersey, but sitting there
with
talking
Curry on the
to
back,
Steph
number
Curry.
30, yes. So there was a little bit of intrigue there.
And how did the Golden State Warriors fans react to that?
They weren't that happy.
Okay. I have to talk about one more thing, which is interesting, that you know, we've been talking about all the severe weather that's been going on in this country. A lot of tornadoes have been hitting people, especially in the middle part of the country. But there was one couple in Kansas that had a different take on a twister this week.
Oh, this is one where you have to just go look for storm chaser engagement picture, and you will find it, and you will see where better to ask the person who you love to marry you than in front of a tornado that is at the back, and you can see all the clouds spreading out, the tornado at the back. I used to work in weather, so I know how exciting it is when you are in the middle of a big, we call them a weather event, and it actually is pretty sexy because nature is amazing to look at. So that picture there with that proposal was beautiful, and a lot of people were looking at it going, well, that's pretty impressive. Where else am I going to do my engagement pictures? Citizens United got us here, says, adorable, but how hope he knows how to run in his flip-flops.
Right, because he's in his flip-flops with the tornado in
and
the background.
And it's right there. But this is, I mean, that really gives you that insight into what it's like to be a storm chaser, because you are going where most people are trying to run away from. And so there were a lot of people just like, this is very impressive and also scary. Please don't die.
Well, and I have to say, you know, at one time in my life, because I grew up in Illinois, I went out as a reporter with a bunch of storm chasers and we drove all the way to Iowa.
Yeah.
Looking for tornadoes and didn't find any. It's pretty rare, actually, as a storm chaser.
Because you're never quite sure when the turbulence is going to happen.
And the idea that
you're
there's
making
a
me
tornado,
get all nerdy now, Jeremy.
Well,
thank you.
The idea that there's a tornado behind you,
yeah,
and your thought is, let me get down on my knee and propose.
And the photographer's there as well.
Right, the photographer's there.
Go look for it online. You'll find it.
They're safe, so that's the good news. Femi Oke, spell your name for me before we leave.
Femioke, so easy.
There you go. Host of the stream on Al Jazeera English. Thanks a lot, as always. Have a great weekend.
You're welcome. Take care.
Here and Now is supported by Daily Harvest. Daily Harvest delivers carefully sourced, chef-crafted smoothies, soups, harvest bowls, overnight oats, and more, all built on fruits and vegetables. Each single serving cup can be prepared in minutes. Daily Harvest is designed for convenience, so you can load up on fruits and vegetables first thing in the morning, before bed, and any time in between. Learn more about Daily Harvest and get 3 free cups in your first box when you go to dailyharvest.com and use promo code NOW. That's dailyharvest.com. Use promo code NOW.
And here's a little item that may have been lost in the stream of news over the last couple weeks. A report came out from the nonpartisan Congressional Research Service that said the huge tax cuts that President Trump signed into law in December 2017 didn't have much effect on the economy at all. This was a $1 trillion-plus package that President Trump said would be rocket fuel for the economy. Joining us now is Howard Gleckman, who is a senior fellow at the Urban Brookings Tax Policy Center. Welcome to Here and Now.
Thanks, Jeremy. Good to be with you.
Well, and what do you think when you hear that the Congressional Research Service, this nonpartisan group, has come out and said that the tax cuts were not rocket fuel for the economy?
Well, a couple of things. The first thing is it's no surprise. The Tax Policy Center, as well as a number of other independent analysts, came to the same conclusion, at least the same prediction, over a year ago, just about the time the law passed. Nearly everyone who looked at this, other than the Trump administration itself, felt that this would have very little effect on the economy.
But when you hear what President Trump and others are saying about the state of the economy right now, they make the case that it really has taken off in the last several years, even though it hit bottom, you know, back in 2009 and has been steadily climbing since then. But when you look at the stock market during the Obama years, as soon as you got to President Trump and then the tax cut, it did go up a lot faster at that point. What about that? What about the stock market? Or is that just the stock market is not the economy and we shouldn't be looking at that as the measure?
So they weren't looking at the stock market. They were looking at the real economy. Mm-hmm. And the trends in the real economy, the most important thing they found was the trends that occurred after the law passed were essentially the same as what they were before the law passed. You know, normally, if you saw a big piece of legislation that affected the economy, you'd see an inflection point. You'd see something dramatically changing from the time before the law passed to the time after it passed, and that just didn't happen here. What we saw was for the first couple of quarters and the first half of 2018, there was a little bit of bump in investment. There was a little bit of bump in GDP. But the investment bump disappeared. Wage growth never really happened. There was some small increase in wages, but again, it was pretty much the same as it was before the law passed. So we just didn't see much that you could tie to the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act.
Well, and in fact, when you look at the amount of money that was saved by the tax cuts, the report says that from 2017 to 2018, the estimated average corporate tax rate fell from 23.4% to 12.1%, a big drop. And individual taxes as a percentage of personal income fell from 9.6% to 9.2%. So corporations, it appears, saw a much bigger benefit than workers.
That's right. The effective tax rate on corporations was pretty much cut in half, as that study showed. Now, the interesting thing was that you remember back to what the Trump people were saying at the time the law was being debated. Their argument was that this corporate tax cut would generate an enormous amount of business investment that business investment would make workers more productive, and eventually workers would get a big raise. And the administration even put a number on it. They said that raise would be somewhere between $4,000 and $9,000 a year, which is an enormous benefit for people. Well, what happened, in fact, was that corporate investment did bump up a little bit, but not very much. Companies didn't give employees raises, not right away. So what did the companies do with all that money? They bought back stock and they gave shareholders dividends. And essentially what that says is that the companies couldn't think of anything productive to do with the money, so they gave it back to their shareholders.
One thing that did go way up after the tax cuts was the deficit. Many people said the tax cuts would pay for themselves. That clearly hasn't happened.
That's right. And again, most of the independent analysts thought that this would lose a lot of revenue. It did. The Congressional Research Service estimate was that it lost about $170 billion in 2018, which is pretty consistent, again, with what most people figured. The argument that this was going to pay for itself was never a serious argument. It was a political claim. No real economist ever thought that was going to happen. And in fact, it didn't.
So when you finally take a look at this analysis from the Congressional Research Service, you know, a couple years later, in the midst of all the other news that's going on in this world and all the other things that people have to pay attention to, does something like this actually inform the discussion in the future about whether to put in another big tax cut like this, which if you'd ask any Republican right now, would they like another one of these? They'd probably say yes.
Well, it's interesting because you remember that in the campaign, Republicans never really got very much traction talking about this tax cut. Democrats talked about it more than Republicans, and they talked about it as a tax cut for the rich and for corporations. And this study confirms that it was, in fact, a tax cut for corporations. You know, the argument is that, you know, you remember the old James Carville line, it's the economy stupid. But the question is, are people going to tie a strong economy, assuming it is still strong in a year, in an election season, are they going to tie that strong economy to this law? And frankly, I think it's going to be very difficult to do. I think people's memory of this legislation will have faded. It'll be 3 years from the time the bill passed till the time that people vote for president again. And it's hard to find any effects. The other thing that's important to note is that this tax cut didn't occur in a vacuum. There's a lot of other things going on in the economy, some good, some bad. You know, so one of the things that happened in 2018 was Congress passed a big spending bill. So that added some stimulus to the economy, and that could have amplified the benefits of this tax bill. But the other thing that happened was the president imposed very strict tariffs on not only China, but many of our other trading partners. We might have seen more of an effect, but because the president followed up this big tax cut with tariffs, which are in fact a big tax increase, much of the benefit of the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act was washed away.
That's Howard Gleckman, who's a senior fellow at the Urban Brookings Tax Policy Center. Howard, thanks for joining us.
Good to be with you, Jeremy.
Well, there's an unusual event taking place in Kansas tomorrow. Thousands of cyclists from around the world will participate in the Dirty Kansas 200. It's the top race in the emerging sport of gravel cycling, and it's lifting rural economies across the country. Jay Price of member station WUNC reports from Emporia, Kansas.
That's the notoriously sharp rock of the Flint Hills under a specially reinforced bike tire. In just a few years, Emporia has done something many rural communities across America can only dream of, built an internationally known brand. And from a pretty humble attraction, gravel roads, unusually harsh gravel roads, Jim Cummins is a co-founder of Dirty Kansas, a grueling 200-mile race that's so popular it now has to turn away thousands of hopeful riders each year.
It's transformed the town. It's made Emporia a vacation destination. You can walk up and down the commercial street in our downtown business district on any given weekend, and you'll see out-of-state license plates with bike racks.
The town now bills itself as the gravel riding capital of the world. And this year, Dirty Kansas and the sport itself has reached a tipping point. Professional riders from two World Tour teams that contest the Tour de France will compete for the first time. They'll line up alongside 3,200 other riders. The visitors to Emporia, about 7,000 total, including support crews, are coming from all 50 states and 28 foreign countries.
We have quite a contingent coming from Iceland. Several Scandinavian countries, a lot of the Western European nations, Australia, New Zealand.
That's how it came to be that two riders were discussing the fickle Kansas weather in Icelandic over beers at the local brew pub. And just around the corner, French visitors asked in halting English about the freshness of the pastries at Gravel City Roasters. Angie Baker owns the cafe, which is decorated with bike parts and a huge board that riders sign.
Everyone looks forward to it. It's kind of like Christmas in June.
She brought in extra staff and stockpiled supplies. Outside the cafe, Emporia's classic Main Street is decorated with banners celebrating past winners of the race. Merchants built window displays and bike themes and are extending their hours. Baker said it's not all about the money, though.
It's exciting to see the same people year after year that want to come back to your town, because that means that you've done a good job.
For locals, the race is a kind of festival. Many volunteer for race support, families come out for the food tents, and in what has become a tradition, kids line the finish chute to high-five tired riders just before they cross the line. Out on the race route, farm families stand in their yards and at dusty crossroads, handing out water paid for out of their own pockets to parched riders. The race itself is a grueling thing that can take more than 20 hours to finish. There's often scorching sun, stiff headwinds, and gummy mud. And always that tire-shredding flint.
People come here and they get out in the middle of the Flint Hills and they get immersed in its vastness and its ruggedness.
For many riders, intentionally or not, it does become more about self-discovery than competing. Some years, more than a quarter drop out. With the rapid rise of the sport, smaller gravel events are popping up from Idaho to Georgia, promoting whatever is daunting about their roads, like sticky clay mud or unusually hard climbs.
It has exploded, definitely.
Jason O'Mahony runs a website called Gravel Cyclist. The number of races on pavement has declined for various reasons, and gravel is filling in some of the void.
Promoters have looked for alternatives to maybe generate some income, or a lot of these events are free. So I would imagine there's over 600 races in the United States now.
Tracking all things gravel has led him to ride in at least 60 events. He says these are often in places that are glad for the boost. A plentiful supply of gravel roads is seldom a sign of a thriving economy, after all. But now it can help. For Here and Now, I'm Jay Price.
On Bullseye, I talk with people who make amazing work. Greta Gerwig, Errol Morris, A$AP Ferg. The conversations are real and funny, and they take you somewhere unexpected. Find Bullseye with Jesse Thorne on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Gillette Company is walking the razor's edge once again with its advertising campaigns. Earlier this year, the brand released an ad featuring boys being bullied by other boys and men harassing women. And then the voiceover asks,
"Is this the best a man can get? Is it? We can't hide from it.
Sexual harassment is taking over.
It's been going on far too long."
Well, this past week, the company posted a Facebook ad that shows a father teaching his transgender teen how to shave. And that video quickly went viral as well, but not without controversy. Here and Now media analyst John Carroll joins us now. And John, first of all, what's the company's thinking behind this latest campaign?
Well, Gillette executives say that brands have a responsibility to use their voice to champion issues of great relevance. So they've taken their tagline, "The best a man can get," which has been their slogan for 30 years, and changed it to "The best a man can be." Mm-hmm. They say it's about a new era of masculinity, and they conducted focus groups where a lot of men were saying, "I'm not a bad guy, but I'm not sure how to be a better one."
That ad in January got a lot of exposure, but it also got a pretty mixed reaction.
Yeah, it got over 30 million views on YouTube, but it got almost a million and a half thumbs down responses, which is about double the thumbs ups.
Okay, let's listen to the newest ad. This is the father teaching his child to shave.
south, south, north, north, east, west, never in a hurry. Right.
Warm. Now, don't be scared. Don't be scared. Shaving is about being confident. Oh, you're doing fine. You are doing fine.
The young man in the spot is a transgender rights activist named Samson Bonkeabantu Brown, and that is his real dad. Hmm. It's not an ad dad. Samson wrote on his Facebook page that he's really blessed to have such a supportive family, and he hopes the ad will encourage other trans people to know that the world can be inclusive.
And this is interesting because traditionally advertisers have wanted to run away from controversial issues, right, because of the potential backlash. But it sounds like things are changing.
Things are changing, but the responses have broken along the traditional, predictable cultural fault lines. One conservative blog said about this latest ad that Gillette is continuing its effort to force its progressive agenda down America's throat. Mm-hmm. A talk show provocateur, Piers Morgan, said about the earlier ad that it is absurd virtue signaling PC guff. But the other thing is there's the obligatory YouTube videos of people disposing of Gillette disposable razors, many throwing them in the toilet, which is not the smartest thing to do.
But should we trust Gillette's good intentions here? Because here we are, we're talking about it. We've played the ads, and clearly the company thinks it can sell more razors by doing this.
Right, but there are other potential benefits too. Some point to the ability to inoculate themselves against charges of insensitivity or sexism. 30-40% of their customers are women. There's also the issue of speaking out on social issues, that young people want brands to speak out, take a stand on social issues, and that's a market that they're looking for.
Other brands have done that. Look what Nike did with Colin Kaepernick earlier. John Carroll, media analyst for Here and Now, will have a link to his campaign outsider blog at our website, hereandnow.org.
This week, Senator and presidential candidate Bernie Sanders released a campaign ad that shows him in the town of Denmark, South Carolina, talking to people there about discolored drinking water that they say has caused health problems for years.
It strikes me that the water crisis in this country, which goes well beyond South Carolina, is an issue we just don't talk enough about. I mean, this is the year 2019. What you're saying is you have to travel 12 miles, go to a good spring, fill up on water and bring it back in the United States of America.
So that's South Carolina, but residents of Martin County, Kentucky can relate. They've been struggling with a similar water issue for more than a year. Videos posted online show yellow water flowing out of the tap, and now some state lawmakers are calling on Kentucky's Republican Governor Matt Bevin to declare a state of emergency. One of those lawmakers is Chris Harris, who represents Martin County in the state General Assembly. He's a Democrat and joins us now. Representative Harris, describe the problem in Martin County. Some residents have said the tap water is discolored and smells like bleach. What exactly is the problem?
Well, the Martin County water issue has been going on for more than a year. There's a tremendous water loss issue in the county. They're losing, or were at one time, losing over 60% or more of the water that was produced from their plant. And the water has just not been regular. It's not been consistent and reliable. There's been a lot of outages where water is not available. And then when water comes back on, the leaks or cracks in the lines result in that discolored water that you see in those pictures you were just talking about. So
what does it look like? Just describe for our listeners what the water looks like.
Well, it can look different in different areas, depending on the color of the soil in the area where the leak may be. Because what's happening is when the water is shut off, the leaks, the water and soil around the cracks in the lines are leaking back into the lines, and then the water comes back on. It's, the system gets recharged, and it pushes that discolored water to the end user. It's not like that folks have discolored water all the time. It's just that when water is turned on and off, the water in the line gets dirtied, And then that is pushed through to the end user. And so they have to let their water run to let that bad water get out.
Now, people have been complaining about this problem for years. Why hasn't this been solved at this point?
Well, the problem in Martin County is the result of years of neglect. The system was not maintained the way that it should have been maintained. Martin County is a very poor county. And quite frankly, the previous board members did not want to raise rates on the people of the county and didn't do that. So they didn't have the money to make the repairs that needed to be made along the way. The result is now you've got a system that is completely deteriorated, and it's affecting, having a tremendously bad effect on the people that live in Martin County and rely on this source of water for drinking and bathing and cooking and all the things that we use public water for.
Is it dangerous, do you think, for your constituents? You know, is this like what we saw in Flint, Michigan, where it could actually cause health problems for people?
Well, I think we have a little better opportunity to make the repairs than what Flint has. You know, Flint had a systemic issue with the entire system. Here we have just really neglect of the system. Over the years, some people have been allowed to put in their own lines that weren't put in properly, that resulted in, you know, cracks in the line, and that mm-hmm. allows that dirt and sediment to infiltrate the line and creates this bad water. But yes, it is dangerous. You know, there's a lot of people, elderly folks, people with handicaps that rely on their public drinking water significantly. And it's not easy for them to go to the grocery store and buy clean drinking water. I mean, they can't get out, and they're not as mobile as some of us may be. And so, yes, it is a health concern. It's a serious problem that is the result of years of neglect. And you know, just to kind of take it a step further, there's this mass conversation across the country right now about regulation and how, you know, we need to cut red tape and less mm-hmm. regulation is always better. Well, this is one of those situations where less regulation is not better. If the state would have been regulating the Martin County Water District all along, it would have realized that it wasn't maintaining the system the way that it was supposed to maintain it. And the people of Martin County would not be without a good, reliable source of drinking water right now.
So you sponsored a resolution calling on the governor, their Republican governor, Matt Bevin, to declare a state of emergency in Martin County, Kentucky, and to make emergency funds available to resolve this water crisis. What have you heard from the governor's office?
We haven't heard any response from the governor's office. There's been some grants, mostly federal money, that has come down and been designated to assist the water district in making the repairs that need to be made. It's not nearly enough. It's a dire situation in the county right now without a good, reliable source of clean drinking water, and making emergency funding available is really our only choice at this point without grant assistance, additional grant assistance from the state or federal government.
So the other part of this story has to do with the amount of money people are having to pay for water. Last year, Kentucky's Public Service Commission approved rate increases in part to pay down the water district's debt. There have been complaints that people are now paying more for unclean water. Some people in the county have said they're happy to pay more if it'll help. But this, as you said, you're dealing with people who, in many cases, do not have very much money. How big of a problem is that part of this story, that you're just bleeding your residents dry of the money that they have to pay for water that's not even reliable?
Right. And this is something that we're seeing over and over again with our public, you know, with utilities in general, not just public utilities, but private utilities, is that the rates are becoming unaffordable for folks. You know, electric rates, water rates, things that people need, they're just becoming almost luxuries. Martin Countyans have seen a 44% rate increase over the last year and a half in their water rates. That's a problem for mm-hmm. a community and a county that really is one of the poorest counties in the country. So because of mismanagement and because these increases weren't done gradually over many, many years. Now they're faced with a, you know, with a steep increase. An additional thing that the Public Service Commission of Kentucky ordered, which I did not agree with, they ordered that the water district would have to hire an outside operator to come in and operate the district. Well, that's not going to be done without a cost. Now we're introducing profit into the equation. So there's going to be somebody there operating the district, making a profit. And so if we just had in place a quality regulatory framework at the state level or the national level to make sure that these small water districts who may not have professional management at the district, that they have proper oversight and are regulated to the point where they can provide the public with a reliable, clean source of drinking water. I think that's where we need to go. And Martin County may be the first that we've seen show the dilapidation in the infrastructure come to this point, but it won't be the last. And there will be others. And if we don't get ahead of this, if we don't start developing and implementing a system of oversight over these small water districts, there are going to be a lot more people that are in the same situation that, that little Martin County, Kentucky is in right now.
That is Chris Harris, who's a Democratic state representative in the Kentucky General Assembly. He represents Martin County, which is dealing with a water crisis right now. Chris Harris, thanks for joining us.
Jeremy, it's great to be with you.
And by the way, if you were tuned in last week when we were broadcasting from WFPL in Louisville, Kentucky, you know how we found this story. We asked a reporter, Philip Bailey, there about a story that we weren't paying attention to, that the national media are not paying attention to, that they should be. And he said the Martin County water crisis. So thanks to him, and glad that we brought this story to our listeners today. Let us know what the water is like where you are at hereandnow.org.
There are roughly 200 educational institutions across the country that offer college classes inside prisons, and there's a debate about whether they make a difference. Prisons measure the success of these programs according to whether an inmate relapses into crime after being released. Illinois Newsroom's Lee Gaines reports.
Johnny Page grew up in Chicago, and he joined a gang when he was about... He joined a gang when he was about 11 years old. He started selling drugs, he was arrested, he was shot, and then his life took a turn for the worse.
And so a guy was killed. I got called responsible for it. I can tell you flat out, I had nothing to do with it.
The state of Illinois disagreed. At 18 years old, Page was sentenced to more than 2 decades in prison. That was in 1992. It wasn't until 2009 that Paige heard about a new college in prison program, the Education Justice Project. It brings University of Illinois classes to the Danville Correctional Center in East Central Illinois. That's an all-male, medium-security prison with about 1,700 inmates. Paige enrolled.
Honestly, I just wanted as much information as I could possibly have, because I felt like I was sitting in a cell because it was information I didn't have. It was some gaps.
Since 2009, more than 220 incarcerated people have taken U of I classes through the program. 10 years in, and EJP, the Education Justice Project, is at an existential turning point.
We need a way to measure our success.
That's Rebecca Ginsburg. She directs EJP.
I'm saying that because many of the people who are saying we have a way to measure our success are, in my opinion, wrongheaded. And that way is typically through measuring recidivism of students who have completed the program.
EJP got a grant to figure out how to evaluate the program beyond recidivism rates. The program hired Nicole Robinson to do that. She says it's hard to get prison staff and policymakers to care about measures that aren't about whether students return to prison.
What I anticipate to be hard, and what already feels hard, is that this work could be perceived as completely irrelevant.
the data aren't reliable. But EJP says the recidivism rate for its students is only about 5%. And there's a study from the RAND Corporation that found that people who participate in prison education programs are 43% less likely to return to prison. But that study bothers Mary Gould.
It requires programs to say, here are our recidivism statistics, because it put in the minds of everyone in the public and policymakers and researchers and folks in the DOC that really the outcome is recidivism.
Gould is the interim director of the Alliance for Higher Education in Prison. That's a group that advocates for the expansion of higher ed in prisons nationwide.
So we're just leaving the vault and we're going to walk down to the visitor center.
I recently traveled with Gould to a prison in Bon Terre, Missouri. She directs a college and prison program there. The visitors' room is where everyone gathers for events.
It's a very pretty stark, bright white environment.
Inside, there's about 55 men in prison uniforms sitting in rows. Everyone's here to talk about philosophy with professors from all around the country, including one from Harvard.
And so when we talk about the allegory of the cave, that's really synonymous with, you know, this prison system.
Gould says participating in an event like this isn't going to determine whether someone comes back to prison.
But is this part of that long and enduring process of gaining something that will eventually contribute to the health, the well-being, the success of the individual? Absolutely.
Ginsburg, like Gould, says recidivism data don't reveal much about what happens to people when they leave prison.
They don't capture people who are homeless. They don't capture people who have been estranged from their family. They don't capture people who are depressed or suicidal.
They don't capture people like Paige. I met up with Paige at his home in Blue Island. It's a red brick two flat in a suburb south of Chicago. Paige was released from prison in 2014. He works at a nonprofit that aims to stop violence by helping young people heal from traumatic experiences.
You can't measure how many people's lives I've saved, right? Because if my goal is to stop retaliatory violence, how do you measure that?
But that is what EJP is trying to measure. I repeatedly asked to visit EJP students inside the Danville prison. The Illinois Department of Corrections denied my requests. The department also turned down requests to discuss the value of EJP. Johnny Page, the EJP alum, is concerned about the program's future.
I've worried about it from the day it started because I understood what it was. It's disruptive.
Page says the program encourages students to think critically and to question everything. He says that's not what the prison system wants from its population. It's a lot of work to keep a college and prison program alive, and Page, Ginsburg, and others say figuring out what that investment of time and money actually does for incarcerated students, beyond whether they return to prison, will hopefully ensure that programs like the Education Justice Project continue to exist. For Here and Now, I'm Lee Gaines.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.